to expound.
Are they?
They are, I answered. And everyone here is... I met her eyes. Yep, just like us. She shook her head in awe, and then her eyes widened and her chin rose, and I turned to see an extraordinarily tall man wobbling down the cobblestones toward us. He was 15 feet high at least, and the top hat he wore added another foot or two. I couldn't have reached even the pocket of his tent-sized floral trousers if I'd reached my arms up and jumped. Hugh hailed him as he passed.
Hello, Javier. How goes the production?
The tall man stopped too quickly and had to pinwheel his arms and steady himself against the roof of a building to keep from toppling over. Then he bent to look at Hugh.
Sorry, didn't see you down there,
he boomed.
The production's hit a snag, unfortunately. Some cast members have been called away on loop rehabilitation assignments, so we're restaging the Grass Menagerie instead. They're over in the green rehearsing right now.
He gestured with his comparatively normal-length arm to a pocket of muddy grass across the street, the closest thing the acre had to a park, where a troop of Miss Grackle's student actors were tottering around in grotesque animal costumes, practicing their lines. Nora gaped at them as we walked on, engrossed in the strange sight, until Hugh kicked the stones and muttered to himself,
Too bad. I was looking forward to coaching the actor who plays me.
Nora turned, a half-smile forming on her lips. They're doing a play about you? I felt the heat of embarrassment start creeping up my neck.
Yeah, one of the Imbrins has a theater troupe. It's no big deal.
I waved my hand dismissively and peered ahead, hoping to find a quick way to distract her and change the subject.
Oh, don't be modest, said Hugh. It's a whole play about how Jacob helped save us from the whites and banish Cole to an interdimensional hell.
It's a big honor, said Bronwyn, grinning broadly. Jacob's really famous around here.
Whoa, check that out,
I shouted, hoping Nora hadn't heard that last bit. I pivoted and pointed at a small crowd of people in nearby Pie Square, where it looked like two peculiars were competing at something.
It's a door lifter contest,
Bronwyn said, successfully distracted.
I've been meaning to enter, but I need to train a bit first.
Let's not dawdle, said Hugh,
but Bronwyn slowed to stare as we passed by, as did the rest of us. There were a dozen people standing on a door that was laid across a pair of sawhorses, and a strapping young guy was facing off against a distinctly unmuscular older lady with a face mean enough to freeze water.
That's Sandina, Bronwyn said. She's amazing.
The small crowd was chanting her name now.
Sandina! Sandina!
The lady knelt below the door, planted her broad shoulders against it, and then rose slowly to her feet, groaning, the dozen people atop her swaying and cheering. Bronwyn was cheering too, and even Nora let out a little whoop, her face all surprise and wonder. Wonder, not horror, not revulsion, and I started to think she might just fit in here. I suddenly realized I didn't know where we were heading. Bronwyn and Hugh had said something about our house, but last I'd checked, our friends were living in the rambling dormitories that occupied the ground level of the Panlupticon. When we started to cross a ramshackle footbridge over Fever Ditch, I finally asked where we were going.
Miss P moved us out of Bentham's house while you were at the bone mender's, Hugh explained. Away from nosy folk and their prying ears. Watch out for this board, it's loose.
He hopped over a plank that fell away and splashed into the black water below. Nora stepped over it easily, but it took me a head-swimming moment to stretch out my leg and force myself over the gap. We reached the other side, then walked parallel along the banks of the ditch until we came to a rickety old house. Its design seemed to defy the laws of gravity and architecture. It was narrower by half at the bottom level than it was at the top, as if the house were standing on its head, and the second and third floors, which had expanded to reach out over empty space, were supported by a forest of spindly wooden stilts and crutches that stretched down to the ground. It was also humbler at the bottom, more or less a shack, while the second floor had big windows and carved columns, and the third had a kind of half-built arched dome atop it, all of it hanging at unstraight angles and stained by time and neglect.
"It ain't the fanciest habitation," Bronwyn admitted, "but at least it's ours."
And then I heard a high, familiar voice say my name, and I craned my neck to see Olive float out from behind a cupola on the roof. She was carrying a bucket and a rag and had a taut rope tied around her waist.
"Jacob!" she cried. "It's Jacob!"
She waved excitedly, and I waved back, thrilled to see her and relieved for the kind greeting. In her excitement, Olive dropped the bucket she'd been holding, which landed on a part of the roof I couldn't see, and elicited a shout of surprise from somebody else, though I couldn't tell who it was. Then the front door before us burst open so hard, one of its hinges flew off with a ping. Emma came racing out.
"Look who we found," Bronwyn announced.
Emma stopped a few feet short of where I was standing and looked me up and down. She had on heavy black boots and rough blue work clothes. Her cheeks were apple red beneath a coating of grime, and she was puffing as if she'd just run down several flights of stairs. And she looked wild, her face a complicated blend of emotions, anger and joy and hurt and relief.
"I don't know whether to slap you or hug you."
I broke into a grin. "Let's start with a hug."
"You complete ass! You scared the life out of us!"
She ran forward and threw her arms around my neck.
"I did,"
I said, playing innocent.
"One minute you're injured in bed, and the next you're gone without a word to any of us. Of course you did."
I sighed and told her I was sorry.
"Me too,"
she whispered, burying her forehead in my neck, then yanking it suddenly away again a moment later, as if she'd remembered she couldn't do that anymore. Before I could ask what she was sorry for, I felt a jolt as another body collided with us. I looked down to see the arms of a purple velvet smoking jacket wrapped around me.
"Wonderful! Wonderful that you've returned to us alive and well," Millard was saying. "But may we have our reunion somewhere other than a public street?"
And he began shoving us toward the house. Tumbling through the tilting door, I glanced over my shoulder to find Noor, but saw only Bronwyn's and Hugh's beaming smiles. And then I was being led into a cozy, low-ceilinged living room kitchen stable, judging by the chickens clucking in one corner and the hay scattered around, and my friends were rushing into the room, one after another. Suddenly, I was being attacked by hugs, and there was a loud, happy hubbub, everyone talking all at once.
"Jacob, Jacob, you're back!"
cried Olive, stomping down a creaking staircase as fast as her lead shoes would allow.
"And you're alive,"
shouted Horace, jumping and waving a tall silk hat.
"Of course I am," I said. "It's not like I was going to get myself killed." "You couldn't know that," said Horace, "and neither could I, distressingly. I've had no dreams at all lately."
"America is a dreadful, dangerous place," said Millard, still glued to my side.
"What were you thinking, going off like that without a word?" "He didn't think we'd care,"
said Bronwyn with incredulous flair. Emma tossed her hands up.
"Oh, for bird's sake, Jacob, Do you even know us at all?
I'd already gotten you in so much trouble with the Imbrins, I tried to explain, and then there were all the things we said. I honestly can't even remember. Neither could I, come to think of it, only how I'd felt afterward, hurt and angry that they had sided with Miss Peregrine over me.
People say things when they're upset, Hugh snapped. It doesn't mean they don't care if you live or die.
We're family,
Olive said, looking up at me sternly, hands on her hips.
Don't you know that?
Something about her little face screwed up into a frown made my insides melt a little.
Wah, wah, wah! My friends were mean to me,
whined Enoch, plodding down the stairs with a sloshing pail of water.
I'll play hero by myself and get into so much trouble I need rescuing. That'll show them.
Nice to see you too.
That goes for one of us. Thanks to you, we've been shoveling flaming manure and unclogging sewer drains for 2 days.
He shouldered past me and flung the wet and chunky contents of the pail out into the street, then wiped his dirty brow with the back of his even dirtier hand.
They might be in a forgiving mood, but you owe me, Portman.
Fair enough, I said. He put out his hand. It dripped.
Welcome back.
I pretended not to notice the filth and shook it. Thanks.
How'd the girl saving go, anyhow? Complete failure, I assume, judging by the fact that she's nowhere to be seen.
I turned around to look, alarmed.
Nor? She was just here, said Bronwyn.
I started to panic, then heard her voice.
Over here!
And I turned to see Nor emerge from a patch of darkness that hadn't been there when we came in, a faint glow rolling slowly down her throat. I let out the breath I hadn't realized I'd been holding.
Impressive, said Millard.
You don't have to hide, said Olive. We don't bite.
I wasn't, said Nor. You guys seemed like you needed a moment to yourselves, that's all. I went over to her, feeling guilty that I hadn't introduced her yet. Some of you have already met her, but for those who haven't, everybody, this is Nor Pradesh. Nor, this is everybody.
Nor gave a general wave to the room.
Hey, everybody.
As my friends gathered around to greet her, she seemed remarkably calm, a totally different person from the one who had nearly refused to go in the Untouchables' morgue drawer.
Welcome to Devil's Acre, Horace said, offering a prim handshake. Hopefully you don't find it too disgusting.
It's pretty astounding so far, said Nor.
I hope you'll stay here with us, said Hugh. After all you've been through, you deserve a rest.
It's nice to finally meet you in person, said Olive. The others have talked so much about you. Well, shouted about you mostly.
I patted Olive's shoulder and moved her along. Okay, Olive, thank you. Emma swooped in and gave Nor a hug, which looked a bit forced.
Don't take what we said before to mean we're not happy to have you. We are.
Hear, hear, said Millard.
Enoch wiped his hand on his trousers before extending it to Nor.
Pleasure to see you again. I'm glad Jacob didn't screw this up. Worse than he did, anyway.
He was great, Nor said. He and the old man were... She winced, remembering.
What happened? Said Emma.
Nor looked quickly at me, then back at Emma. Her voice went gravelly as she said,
He died.
H broke Nor out of Leo's loop, I said. He was shot, but hung on until he got Nor back to his place. That's where I found them. I felt callous saying it so quickly and matter-of-factly, but there it was.
I'm very sorry to hear that, said Millard. I never met him, but any compatriot of Abe's was doubtless a good man.
My God, Emma said. Poor H.
She was the only other one of us who had met him,
and the mournful look she gave me said, "We'll talk later."
"I owe him my freedom," Nor said quietly,
and it seemed there was nothing more to say. There was a brief, awkward moment of quiet, which Millard broke by saying to Nor,
"In any case, I'm very glad you're not in the hands of that awful Leo Burnham anymore."
"Me too," said Nor.
"That guy was..."
She shook her head slowly, unable to find just the right words.
"They didn't hurt you, did they?" asked Bronwyn.
"No. They asked me lots of questions and told me I was going to be in their army, and then put me in a locked room for 2 days, but they didn't hurt me."
"Thank God for that, at least," I said. Then a small voice asked,
"Was it worth it, Jacob? Risking so much for her?"
I turned to see Claire glaring at me from the doorway, her sour expression a sharp contrast to the yellow rubber boots and hat she wore.
"Claire, that's rude," said Olive. "No, Jacob was rude when he disobeyed Miss Peregrine, even though it might have meant a war breaking out that the Imbrans had been trying very hard to prevent."
"Well, did it?" I said.
"Did it what?"
"Start a war?" Claire clenched her fists and made the angriest face she could.
"That's not the point."
"Your and H's actions did not, as a matter of fact, spark a war."
Miss Peregrine, striking in an angular black dress and upswept hair, had appeared on the landing of the stairs.
"Not yet, at any rate, though you may have brought us to the brink of one."
The headmistress wafted down the steps and made a beeline for Nor.
"So you're the famous Miss Pradesh," she said evenly.
She dashed out her hand and shook Nor's once, quickly.
"My name is Alma Peregrine, and I'm headmistress to these sometimes intractable children."
Nor gave a crooked half-smile, as if she found Miss Peregrine vaguely amusing.
"Nice to meet you," she said. "Jacob didn't mention anything about a war."
"No."
Miss Peregrine turned to face me.
"I don't imagine he did."
I felt my face go hot.
"I know you must be angry, Miss P, but helping Nor was something I had to do."
I felt Nor's eyes on me, and everyone else's, but I didn't look away from the Imbrin.
Miss Peregrine held my gaze a moment longer, then turned abruptly, walked to a door, and opened it to reveal a small sitting room. "Mr. Portman, you and I have a few things to discuss. Miss Pradesh, you've had an exhausting few days. I'm sure you'd appreciate a chance to rest and freshen up. Bronwyn, Emma, please help our guest get settled."
Nor gave me a questioning look, a kind of, "What the hell is going on?" And I replied with a quick shake of my head that I hoped said, "Everything's fine." And then Miss Peregrine shuttled me into the room and closed the door. The room was lined with thick fur rugs, and the only furniture was a pile of pillows on the floor. Miss Peregrine walked to a cloudy window and looked out for what seemed like a long time.
"I should have known you'd do this," she began. "It's my fault, really, for leaving you alone and unguarded."
She shook her head.
"It's just what your grandfather would have done."
"I'm sorry for any trouble I caused," I said.
"But I'm not sorry for..." "Trouble can be handled," she interrupted. "But we could not handle losing you."
I'd been all ready to argue, to make an impassioned case for why I'd gone to help H rescue Nor from Leo Burnham, and she'd caught me off guard.
"Then you're not angry?"
"Oh no, I am livid, but I learned long ago to control my emotions." She turned fully to face me, and I saw that her eyes were rimmed with tears.
"It's good to have you back, Mr. Portman. Never do anything like that again."
I nodded, choking back tears of my own. She cleared her throat, rolled her shoulders, and reset her expression.
"Now then, you are going to sit down and tell me everything. I believe you were saying something about how you had to do this."
There was a sharp knock at the door, and without waiting for an answer, it opened. Noor came inside. Miss Peregrine frowned.
I'm sorry, Miss Pradesh. We're having a private conversation. Jacob has something to tell me. There's something he and I need to talk about.
She pinned me with her eyes.
This prophecy, you made it sound urgent.
What prophecy? Miss Peregrine said sharply.
Apparently it's got something to do with me, Noor said. So I'm sorry, but I can't let someone else hear about it before I do.
Miss Peregrine looked both surprised and impressed.
I completely understand. I suppose you'd better come in.
She gestured to a pillow on the floor. We settled among the pillows. Miss Peregrine looked regal, even sitting on the floor, back straight and her hands lost in the black folds of her dress. I told her and Noor about the prophecy, or what I'd heard of it anyway, and what had preceded its telling. I caught Miss Peregrine up on some details she didn't yet know, such as how I'd snuck out of the Panopticon to find H in New York, and what I'd found when I reached his apartment. Noor sleep-dusted on H's sofa, H mortally wounded on the floor. Then I told them what he'd said to me just before he died. I wished now that I had written down his exact words while they were still fresh in my mind. So much had happened since they were told to me that they were becoming a bit jumbled. H said there was a prophecy that foretold your birth, I said, looking at Noor. You were one of the seven who would be the emancipators of peculiardom. She looked at me like I was speaking Greek.
What's that supposed to mean?
I don't know, I said, and looked hopefully to Miss Peregrine. Her expression was neutral.
Is there more?
I nodded. He said a new and dangerous age was coming, which I guess is what the seven are supposed to emancipate us from. And he said the prophecy was the reason those men were hunting Noor.
You mean the weirdos who were stalking me at school, said Noor.
Yeah, and who came after us at that building site in the helicopter, and shot Bronwyn with the sleep dart. Miss Peregrine seemed doubtful. Well, I said to Noor, what do you think?
That's it?
Noor's eyebrows rose.
That's the whole thing?
Highly unlikely, Miss Peregrine said. It sounds like H was paraphrasing, attempting to convey the basics to you before he bled to death.
But what does any of that mean? Noor said to Miss Peregrine. Bronwyn said you're someone who knows things.
I am, generally, but obscure prophecies are not my area of expertise.
They were, however, one of Horace's, and so, with Noor's permission, we called him into the room and told him about it. He listened with intense fascination.
The seven emancipators of peculiardom, he said, rubbing a hand over his smooth chin. It rings a bell, but I need more information. Did he say who the prophet was, or where the prophecy came from?
I struggled to remember.
He said something about an... the exact word was escaping me now. An apocryphate? Apocryton?
Interesting, Horace said, nodding. Sounds like a text of some kind. Not one I've heard of, but it's something to go on.
Is that all? Miss Peregrine said. H paraphrased a few lines of prophecy and then expired.
I shook my head. No, the last thing he said was that I should take Noor to find a woman named V.
What?
We turned to see Emma poking her head through the door. She put a hand over her mouth, embarrassed at her outburst, then decided to own it and just came in.
Sorry, but we've all been listening.
The door opened wider, and there were all my friends on the other side. Miss Peregrine let out an irritated sigh.
Oh, come in then, she said. I'm sorry, Noor. There really are no secrets amongst us,
and I have a feeling this may be a matter that will concern all of us.
Nora shrugged.
If anyone can tell me what the hell this all means, I'd write it on a billboard.
An emancipator of peculiardom, huh?
Said Enoch.
Sounds quite fancy.
I gave him an elbow in the ribs as he sat down next to me. Don't start with her, I muttered.
Wasn't my idea, Nora said to Enoch. I think it sounds nuts.
But H must have believed it,
said Millard, his purple jacket pacing the floor,
or he wouldn't have risked his life to save Nora's, and he wouldn't have roped Jacob and the rest of us into helping find her.
You were saying, Emma said to me, about that woman.
V, yes, I said. She's the last hollow slayer left alive, H said. She was personally trained by my grandfather back in the 60s. There are references to her all through his mission logs.
The diviners remembered meeting her more than once, said Bronwyn. They seemed quite impressed with her.
Emma squirmed, unable to hide her unease. Miss Peregrine drew a small pipe from her dress pocket and asked Emma to light it for her, then took a deep draw and let out a puff of green smoke.
I find it very curious, she said to me, that he advised you to seek the help of another hollow hunter, rather than an Imbrin.
Rather than me.
Very curious,
Claire agreed. He seemed to think V was the only person who could help us, I said, but he didn't say why. Miss Peregrine nodded and blew out another green puff.
Abe Portman and I respected each other immensely, but there were a number of matters on which his organization and mine disagreed. It's possible he simply felt more comfortable sending you into the protection of one of his comrades, rather than me.
Or he believed there were things you didn't know about the situation, said Millard.
Or the prophecy, said Horace,
and Miss Peregrine looked briefly annoyed at the reminder. I knew, of course, that H did not fully trust the Imbrins, but he had never explained why, and it wasn't something I was prepared to bring up in front of the others.
He left us a map, said Nor, to find V.
A map? Said Millard, spinning to face her. Do tell.
Just before he died, H directed his hologast, Horatio, to give us a piece of a map from a wall safe, I said. Then he let Horatio eat his eyes. This prompted a disgusted groan from several of my friends, which seemed to allow the hollow to consume his peculiar soul. A few minutes later, he started turning into, I don't know, a white, I guess, or the beginnings of one.
And that's when I woke up, said Nor, and Horatio told us something that sounded like a clue.
Then he jumped out the window, I said.
May I see that map? Said Miss Peregrine.
I handed it to her. Millard's jacket bent over Miss P's shoulder as she smoothed the fragment against her leg, and the room went quiet.
This scrap isn't much to go on,
Millard said, after only a few seconds of study. It's a tiny detail of a much larger document, which is mostly topographical. Horatio's clue sounded like map grid coordinates, I said.
Those might help more if we had the whole map, said Millard, or if the map included place names, towns and roads and lakes.
Actually, said Miss Peregrine, bending closer while holding up a magnifying monocle to one eye, they appear to have been erased.
Curiouser and curiouser, said Millard. You say the ex-hollow uttered something. What was it?
He told us we could find her in a loop, I said. H called it the big wind, and Horatio said it was in the heart of the storm.
Does that mean anything to you?
Nora said to the room generally.
Sounds like a looped hurricane, or a cyclone, said Hugh.
Obviously, said Millard.
What kind of mad Imbrin would loop such a terrible thing?
Olive said.
One who really doesn't want visitors dropping in, said Emma, and Miss Peregrine nodded in agreement. Do you know of such a place? Emma asked her. Miss Peregrine frowned. I don't, sorry to say. It's probably hidden somewhere in America. Again, not my area of expertise. It will be someone's, said Millard. Don't despair, Miss Pradesh. We'll make sense of this yet. May I borrow this? The map appeared to float as he held it up. I looked at Noor, and she nodded. Okay, I said. If I can't crack it, I'll bet someone around here can. I hope so, said Noor. When you go asking around, I'd like to come. Of course, said Millard, sounding pleased. And I can help you find out more about the prophecy, said Horace. You might speak to Miss Avocet, Miss Peregrine said. I was her pupil once upon a time, and I remember she had a special interest in lunacy, divination, and automatic writing. Prophetic texts might fall under that aegis. Fantastic idea, said Horace, his eyes gleaming excitedly. He cocked his head at Miss Peregrine. Though it would help if I could get off cleaning duty for a few days. All right, the headmistress sighed. In that case, you're excused from work too, Millard. That hardly seems fair, Claire whined. I'm sure I could be of help, Enoch said with a grin. Perhaps we should interview the recently deceased H. I remembered the dead man packed in ice that Enoch had helped us question back on Cairnholm and shuddered. No thanks, Enoch, I said. I would never do that to him. He shrugged. I'll think of something. Everyone was chattering in low voices now until Noor got to her feet and cleared her throat. I just wanted to say thanks, she said. I'm brand new here, so I don't know if this sort of thing happens a lot or not. Prophecies and kidnappings and mysterious maps. Not very often, said Bronwyn. We went almost 60 years without much happening at all. Then, thanks, she said, a bit awkward. She was blushing as she sat down.
Any friend of Jacob's is a friend of ours, said Hugh. And this is how we treat friends.
There was a chorus of assent, and suddenly I felt very humbled and very grateful to have such friends as these. Chapter 3. After a while, Miss Peregrine announced that it was dinner time, and that we'd done a not very good job of hosting Noor thus far. And here was our chance to make up for it. We trooped through the house and up the rickety stairs to a dining room, where a long table made from rough planks was set with mismatched cups and plates and a set of windows that looked out onto the polluted river and the crumbling buildings on its opposite bank. In the amber glow of sunset, it looked almost pretty. Noor and I had, finally, a chance to wash up. In the next room, there was a basin and a big pitcher of water beneath a cloudy mirror, and we were able to splash some water on our faces and clean ourselves up a bit. But just a bit. When we came back, Noor sat beside me, and Emma was lighting candles with her fingertip, while Horace oversaw the distribution of food, ladled into bowls from a big black cauldron hanging in the hearth. I hope you like stew, he said, setting a steaming bowl before Noor. The food's great in Devil's Acre, so long as you like stew for every meal.
I'd eat anything right now, she said. I'm starving. That's the spirit.
We settled into easy conversation, and soon the room was filled with the hum of voices and the clatter of spoons. It was remarkably cozy, considering where we were. Making inhospitable places cozy was one of Miss Peregrine's many talents.
What did you used to do in your normal life? Asked Olive through a full mouth.
Go to school mostly, Noor replied. By the way, your use of the past tense there is interesting. Everything's going to change for you, Miss Peregrine said.
It already has, Nor said. My life is unrecognizable from what it was last week. Not that I really want to go back.
That's precisely it, said Millard, jabbing a loaded fork in her direction. It's very difficult to tolerate a normal life once you've lived a peculiar one for a while.
Trust me, I've tried, I said. Nor looked at me. Do you ever miss your normal life?
Not even a little, I said, and I almost meant it.
Do you have a mother and father who will miss you? Asked Olive. Olive was always asking about mothers and fathers. I think she missed hers more than anyone, though she had long since outlived them. I've got foster parents, said Nora. I never met my real ones, but I'm sure Fartface and Tina won't cry too much if I don't come back.
The word Fartface prompted a few curious glances, but they must have assumed it was just a weird present-day people name, because no one said anything.
How do you like being peculiar? Asked Bronwyn.
Nor had hardly been able to take a bite of food, but she didn't seem to mind. It was scary before I knew what was happening to me, but I'm starting to adjust.
Already? Said Hugh. Back in the Untouchables loop.
I have a thing about certain types of confined spaces, she said. That, door, she shook her head ruefully, kind of threw me for a loop.
Threw you for a loop,
Bronwyn shouted, laughing loudly and clapping her hands.
That's very good.
Enoch groaned.
No loop puns, please, intentional or otherwise.
Sorry, Nora mumbled, having used the interruption to finally get some food into her mouth.
Unintentional.
Horace stood up and announced that it was time for dessert, and he whisked off into the kitchen and brought out a big cake.
Where did that come from? Bronwyn cried. You've been holding out on us.
I was saving it for something special, he said. I think this more than qualifies. He served Nora the first slice. Before she could take a bite, he asked her,
When did you realize you were different?
I've been different my whole life, Nora said with a subtle smile. But I only realized I could do this a few months ago. She waved her hand over a candle, took its light between two fingers, and popped it into her mouth. Then she blew it out again like a long stream of glowing smoke, which slowly settled like falling particles of dust back atop the candle.
How wonderful!
Olive cheered as everyone oohed and clapped.
Do you have normal friends? Asked Horace.
One, though I think I like her so much because she isn't very normal.
How is Lily?
Millard asked, a little sigh of longing escaping him. I haven't seen her since you did.
Oh, he said, chastened. Of course, I hope she's well.
Emma, who'd been uncharacteristically quiet, suddenly asked, Do you have a boyfriend?
Emma,
said Millard.
Don't pry.
Emma went red and looked down at her cake.
It's okay, said Nora, laughing. No, I don't.
Guys, I think we should give her a chance to take a few bites, I said, weirdly embarrassed by Emma's question. Miss Peregrine, who had been quietly brooding for the past few minutes, dinged her glass and asked for everyone's attention.
I'm due back at the peace talks tomorrow, she said. The Imbrins are in the midst of very sensitive negotiations with the leaders of the three American clans,
she gravely directed this to Nor,
and the threat of war between them grows with each passing day. I'm sure H's brazen rescue and your disappearance have only made things more complicated.
Oops, Nora said quietly.
You're not to blame, of course. But there will be damage to contain and bruised egos to mollify. That is, if we can even get them back to the negotiating table.
Everyone's calling the peace talks the Conference of the Birds,
Bronwyn stage whispered to Nora. Nora gave her a blank look.
Yeah?
Bronwyn raised her eyebrows.
Because the Imbrins can turn into birds.
They can? Said Noor, looking at Miss Peregrine with surprise.
I still don't understand what the big to-do is, said Enoch. Would it really matter that much if the Americans waged war on one another? Why is that any concern of ours?
Miss Peregrine stiffened, then laid down her spoon.
I hate to repeat myself, but as I've said, war is a
virus, said Hugh.
It respects no borders,
Emma said, as if repeating from a textbook. Miss Peregrine rose heavily from her chair and went to the window. We could feel a lecture coming on.
Of course, the Americans are not our priority, she said. We Imbrins care most about rebuilding our society, our loops, our way of life. But the chaos of a war would make that impossible, because war is a virus. I can see you don't understand what that means. It's not your fault. None of you have ever witnessed a war between peculiar factions. But many Imbrins have.
She turned and looked out across the acre, the perpetual smoke that hung above it now stained an imperial violet.
The oldest amongst us remember the disastrous Italian War of 1325. Two peculiar factions rose up against each other, and the battle raged not only across physical borders, but temporal ones. The peculiars fought in loops, and the fighting spilled, inevitably, fierce as it was, into the present. Scores of peculiars died, and thousands of normals. An entire city was burned to the ground, razed flat.
She turned to face us and swept a flat hand through the air, as if to paint a picture of the destruction.
So many normals saw us fighting, there was no containing it. It sparked a pogrom against our kind, a bloody purge that killed many more of us, and drove peculiars out of northern Italy for a century. It took an enormous effort to recover. We had to memory wipe entire towns, rebuild. We even enlisted peculiar scholars, Perplexus Anomalous was one, to revise normal history books, so that the carnage would be remembered as something other than the War of the Freaks, which is what it was called for generations. Finally, Perplexus and his scholars were able to rewrite it as the War of the Oaken Bucket. To this day, normals believe thousands died battling over a wooden pail.
Normals are so stupid, said Enoch.
Not as stupid as they used to be, said Miss Peregrine. That was 700 years ago. Today, if a peculiar war were to break out in earnest, it would be nearly impossible to cover up. It could spill into the present, where it would be filmed, disseminated worldwide, and we would be exposed, ruined, vilified. Imagine the terror of normals witnessing a battle between powerful peculiars. They would think the end times were upon them.
A new and dangerous age,
Horace mused darkly.
But don't the Americans know all this?
Asked Emma.
Don't they understand what could happen?
They claim to, said Miss Peregrine, and they swear up and down that they would adhere to the various conventions of war that dictate a peculiar battlefield must always be in the past, or in a loop. But wars are hard to control, and they don't seem as worried about the consequences as they should be.
Like the Russians and Americans during the so-called Cold War, said Millard. Blinded by mutual distrust, desensitized to the dangers by constant exposure.
I promise our dinner conversations aren't always this depressing,
Olive whispered across the table to Noor. What if that's the dangerous age the prophecy mentions? I said. Could it be predicting a war between peculiars?
It's certainly possible, said Horace.
Then maybe war is inevitable, said Hugh.
No, Miss Peregrine said. I refuse to accept that.
Prophecies are not necessarily fate, Horace said. Sometimes they're just warnings about events that could happen,
or will probably happen if you don't take action to change the course of things.
Hopefully there's nothing to the prophecy at all, Olive said miserably. The whole thing sounds scary.
Yes, I'd rather not need emancipating, thank you very much, said Claire.
I'd rather not have to do any emancipating, said Noor. Though it says I'm one of seven, so I guess I don't have to do it by myself. But who are the other six?
Horace spread his hands.
Another mystery. Pass the salt, please.
Olive's head fell into her hands.
Can we please talk about something nice for a while?
Emma reached over to ruffle her hair.
Sorry, dear. One more thing is bugging me. This supposed secret society that's trying to get their hands on Noor. Who are they?
Wouldn't I love to know, Noor said.
Doesn't the answer seem obvious? Said Millard.
I turned toward him, surprised.
No, should it?
He snapped his invisible fingers.
They're whites.
But H told me specifically they were normals, I said.
And Miss Annie from the Diviner's Loop said something about a secret society of American normals, Bronwyn added, left over from the slave trade days.
Sometimes I underestimated how closely Bronwyn paid attention to things.
Yes, I was there, said Millard. I don't doubt there was such a society in the past, but I seriously doubt any normals would have the wherewithal to pose such a danger to us now. We've been hidden in loops far too long.
I very much agree, said Miss Peregrine.
Last time we talked about it, I said, you told me it sounded like the work of another clan, not whites.
Things have changed, she said. There's been a dramatic uptick in white activity lately. Just in the last few days, there have been multiple sightings.
Attacks? Said Horace, his face paling.
None yet, but reports of movement. All in America.
But I thought only a small group of them managed to escape after the Library of Souls collapsed, Emma said.
Miss Peregrine was slowly circling the table, the shadows cast by a dozen candles flickering over her face.
That's true, but a small number of whites are capable of causing a great deal of trouble, and they may have had a few sleeper agents embedded in America, waiting to be called up. We don't know for certain.
How many are we talking about? Asked Noor. Between the people at my school and the ones from the helicopter attack, there were a lot.
Maybe they weren't all whites, said Bronwyn. They might have hired mercenary normals to help them, or mind-controlled them somehow.
It would be just like whites to attempt such a brazen kidnapping, Millard said. Then make it seem as if someone else was responsible, normals or another American clan.
They're masters of trickery and disguise, after all, said Miss Peregrine. It was Percival Murnau himself who founded the Department of Obfuscation.
She said his name as if I should have heard of him.
Who's that? I asked.
Miss Peregrine stopped beside my chair and looked down at me.
Murnau is, well, was, Cole's top lieutenant. He was the main architect of the raids that destroyed so many of our loops and killed so many of our people. We caught him the day the Library of Souls collapsed, luckily, and he's cooling his heels in our jail, awaiting trial.
He's a nasty man, Bronwyn said, a tremor of revulsion in her voice.
One of my jobs is guarding his cell block. He'll eat anything that crawls into his cell, rats, bugs. Even the other whites don't go near him.
Horace dropped his fork.
Well, my appetite is killed.
So if it was these whites, said Noor, then what do they want with me?
They must know about the prophecy too, said Horace, and believe it, or they wouldn't have gone to all the trouble of finding you.
They found her months ago, Millard said. They could have taken her any time. They were waiting.
For what? I said.
Obviously, for someone else to come after her, he replied.
You think they were using me as bait? Nora said, eyes widening a bit.
Not just bait, said Millard. They wanted you, but they wanted someone else too, and were willing to be patient in order to get them.
Who?
I said. H? Maybe. Or V.
Or you, Mr. Portman, said the headmistress. She let that sink in as I swallowed the last of my cake. I think you and Miss Pradesh need to be very careful. I think someone may be trying to get their hands on the both of you.
After dinner was over, we all went upstairs to bed. The third floor was a warren of small rooms connected by zigzagging hallways that spread across the top level of the house, half reserved for the boys and the other half for the girls. Nora was red-eyed with exhaustion, and I'm sure I looked just as tired. We hardly had the energy to keep ourselves upright.
You'll bunk with Horace and me, said Hugh.
And you can have my bed, Olive said to Nora. I could never. I'll sleep on the floor. It's no trouble, Olive said. I usually sleep on the ceiling anyway.
The facilities are quite basic, inasmuch as there are none, Hugh said.
He pointed at a bucket at the end of the hallway.
That's the bathroom.
He turned and pointed to another bucket at the other end.
And that's clean boiled water to drink. Don't get them confused.
The others left Nora and me alone, just as Miss Peregrine appeared carrying a candle-lit lantern. She had changed into a long-sleeved nightdress, and her hair was loose and trailed down the back of her neck.
I won't see you in the morning, she said regretfully, but I'm only a panlupticon door away. You can always send a messenger to the conference loop if you need to reach me.
I wish you didn't have to go, I said. We could use your help.
If it were for anything less important, I would never go. But at the moment, I have greater responsibilities. I'll be leaving before first light.
She turned to Noor and smiled.
I'm so glad you've come, Miss Pradesh. I hope you feel welcome here. The circumstances of your arrival might not have been ideal, but I am no less glad at your presence.
Thank you, Nora said. I'm glad to be here. Miss Peregrine leaned in and kissed Nora on both cheeks, something I'd only seen her do to other Imbrins or honored guests.
Bird be with you,
she said, and then she was gone down the hall. Tomorrow, we'll dig into all this, I said. If there's more to the prophecy, we'll find it, and Millard will help us decode that map. I held Nora's gaze for an extra beat. This is very important to all of us. Nora nodded.
Thank you,
let out an exhausted breath. I felt a pang of empathy for her and for how she must have been feeling. How are you? I said. Still feeling like you're losing your mind?
It's probably better that I haven't had much downtime to think about everything. For now, I'm just going with it. You know what my brain keeps defaulting to whenever I have a moment of quiet?
What?
That I have a calc test in 2 days and I should be studying.
We both laughed. I think your GPA is going to take a little hit here. Sorry.
It's okay. Everything's bizarre and confusing and so much of this is super scary and messed up. But despite everything that's obviously wrong right now, I actually feel good.
You do? Her voice fell to a near whisper.
Like, for the first time in a long time, I'm not alone.
Our eyes met. I reached out and took her hand. You're not alone, I said. You've got people. She smiled gratefully, then hugged me,
I felt something small but powerful turn in my chest. I bent my head, let my lips rest on top of her hair, almost a kiss. And then we said good night. I had the old dream again, the same one I'd had so many times after my grandfather was killed. It's the night he died, and I'm running through the spiky woods behind his house, screaming his name. Like always, I find him too late. He's lying on the ground, bleeding, a hole in his chest, one of his eyes torn out. I go to him. He tries to speak to me. Usually in these dreams, he does, and he says all the things he said that night. Find the bird, in the loop. But this time, he's only muttering in Polish, and I can't understand. Then I hear another branch snap, and I look up from where I'm kneeling, and there's the monster, covered in Abe's blood, horrible thick tongues waving in the air. He's got Horatio's face, and he says in a guttural, hollow-gassed snarl I can plainly understand,
"He is coming."
I jolted awake to the sound of an explosion. Bolting upright in bed, I saw that Hugh and Horace were already up, crowding each other to get a look out the window. "What's going on?" I shouted, stumbling out of my sheets.
"Something bad," Hugh said.
I joined them at the window. It was first light. Sirens were howling in the distance, and panicked shouts echoed from across the acre. People in other buildings were throwing open their windows and looking out to see what was going on. Bronwyn burst into the room, her hair mussed from sleep.
"What's happened?" she said. "Where's Miss P?"
Emma shoved past her.
"Everyone into the common room," she shouted. "Head count, now!"
A minute later, we were all together, all present and accounted for but Miss Peregrine, who had left for the conference before dawn. Something had happened elsewhere in the acre, an attack, an explosion, something, but we weren't sure what. Through the window, we could hear someone authoritative sounding going down the street and shouting,
"Stay indoors! Do not come out until so instructed!"
"What about Miss P?" Olive said. "What if something's happened to her?"
"I can find out," said Millard. "I'm invisible."
"I can be too," said Nor, and she raked the light from the air before her and stepped into it.
"Let me help."
"I appreciate the offer, but I work better alone."
"It's not worth the risk," Emma said. "Miss P can take care of herself."
"So can I," Millard replied. "Whatever's happening, you can bet no one's going to tell us the whole truth about it. If you want to know anything worth knowing around here, you've got to find out for yourself."
He shrugged off his sleeping robe and it fell to the floor in a pile. Emma tried to make a grab for him.
"Millard, come back here!"
But he had already slipped away. We paced around the common room, chattering nervously while we waited. Nora was humming to herself, arms folded tight. Olive attached a rope around her waist and floated as high as she could out of a third floor window, hoping to get a better view of anything that might be happening.
"I see smoke rising from Smoking Street," she said when we reeled her back in a few minutes later.
"Smoking Street smokes," Enoch said. "That's why it's called Smoking Street."
"All right, I saw an unusual amount of smoke rising from Smoking Street," she clarified, slipping her feet back into her leaden boots. "Dark black smoke."
"That's where the remnants of the White's compound is," Bronwyn said anxiously, "and the prison where we've been keeping the ones we caught."
Nor huddled close to me.
"This is bad, huh?"
"Seems like it," I said.
"Figures. Right when I show up, everything goes wrong."
She pursed her lips and her eyes cut away to the window.
"Sometimes I wonder if I'm just bad luck."
I was starting to tell her that was ridiculous when Millard came back
his bare feet slapping up the stairs and into the room at a run. We all crowded around him.
"What's the news?"
Emma said, but Millard had to catch his breath before he could get a word out, and I think he lay down on the floor. Finally, he managed to say between gulps of air,
"It's the whites."
"Oh, no," I heard Bronwyn say under her breath, as if this one bit of information had just confirmed her worst fears.
"What about them?"
Enoch said, sounding uncharacteristically scared.
"They broke out of jail and escaped."
"All of them?" I said.
"Four."
Millard sat up and wiped his brow with the closest thing at hand, which happened to be an errant sock. Horace brought him a cup of water and he gulped it down, then told the story in feverish bursts. They killed the peculiar who'd been guarding them.
"Thank the birds you weren't on duty," he said to Bronwyn.
Then they made a hole in the wall of their jail big enough to crawl through without attracting attention, snuck over to the Panlupticon, and escaped. The explosion we'd heard was a bomb they'd set off in the Panlupticon hallway.
"What about Miss Peregrine?"
I asked.
"She traveled back to the conference via the Panlupticon shortly before this all happened," Millard said. "One of Sharon's Panlupticon minions confirmed it for me."
"Thank goodness," said Olive.
"Someone had better go fetch her," Emma said. "She needs to know about this."
"That could be a problem," said Millard.
"Why's that?"
"Because the whites took the Hologast, who is powering the Panlupticon, with them. And now the entire apparatus is shut down."
The air seemed to go out of the room. Everyone was stunned.
"What?"
I said.
"How?"
"Well, the whites and the hollows are natural allies."
"No, I mean, how did they use the Panlupticon to escape if they stole the hollow powering it?"
"There must have been a few minutes reserve power remaining in the lines. Just enough for them to make an escape."
I felt my stomach drop.
"What does any of that mean?" Nor said.
"It means that wherever they went, we can't follow them," said Emma, shaking her head.
"It means," Millard said, "we're stuck here for a while."
"And Miss Peregrine is stuck at the conference,"
Claire said miserably,
"along with several of the other Imbrins."
Just then, there was a loud rapping on the window, which was strange since we were on the third floor of the house. Emma rushed over and slid the window open. I heard her say, "Yes?" And a moment later she turned back with an odd expression and said,
"Jacob, it's for you."
I went over to see a dour young man standing on the second floor roof.
"Jacob Portman," he said.
"Who are you?"
"Ulysses Critchley," he said. "I work for Miss Blackbird at the Ministry of Temporal Affairs. She wants to see you. Instantly."
"What's this about?" I said. Ulysses gestured vaguely at the smoke rising from the other side of the acre, now easily visible.
"The fracas."
Then he turned, walked calmly off the edge of the roof, and fell out of view at about half normal speed.
"You'd better go," Emma said insistently. "But I'm coming with you."
"Me too,"
said Enoch and Millard at the same time. Then Millard said to Bronwyn,
"If you wouldn't mind carrying me, I'm a bit shagged out."
She insisted he put on a shirt and trousers before she scooped him up. Then I remembered Noor and the prophecy and everything we were supposed to do today, and I turned to her.
"I'm so sorry," I said. "Today was supposed to be all about..."
She cut me off with a wave.
"It's okay. This is clearly something serious. By the way, I'm coming too."
I smiled. "If you insist," then turned and shouted out the window to Ulysses,
"We'll take the stairs!"
The others wished us luck, and we went out. Chapter 4. Ulysses Critchley had a gravity-defying peculiarity not unlike Olive's, though his unnatural buoyancy wasn't so extreme that he seemed in danger of floating uncontrollably into the sky. He resembled a sped-up version of an astronaut walking on the moon, each little leap he took matching 3 or 4 of our steps. We followed him across the acre. Clusters of worried peculiars congregated here and there in the streets, glancing darkly at the smoke rising in the sky. I kept hearing the word white murmured. Even if they all didn't know exactly what had happened yet, they knew it was something bad. Our defenses had been breached. Our enemies were not as vanquished as we had hoped. As we crossed Smoking Street, we saw Raphael, the bone mender, and an assistant walking alongside 2 men carrying a stretcher, grim expressions all. We stopped at a respectful distance and waited for them to pass.
I wonder who it was, Enoch whispered. Hopefully no one good.
I heard some of the other guards talking, Millard said quietly. I think it was Melina Manon, the telekinetic.
Ah, too bad, Enoch said. She was a bit mad, but I rather liked her.
Have some respect,
Emma hissed.
She's a hero, Bronwyn said, and I saw her wiping away tears.
A jet of smoke vented up from a crack in the street. The sad parade disappeared from view, and we continued on. I didn't know where Ulysses was leading us until I saw Bentham's house. We were going, of course, to the Panlupticon. Some of the upper floor windows had been blown out. A small crowd had gathered around outside a perimeter of caution tape. It seemed the building had been evacuated. Farish Obuelo, the journalist, was there, interviewing people while scribbling furiously in a notepad. Ulysses paused at the entrance, looked up the side of the building as if he'd rather just pull himself up, then glanced back at us and sighed.
Come on, you groundbounds, he said, and led us inside.
We headed for the stairs. Before we could reach them, I saw Sharon coming toward us, his long arms extended.
Young Portman and friends, he boomed. Not a moment too soon.
Sharon's giant form was blocking the stairs.
I'm taking them to Miss Blackbird, said Ulysses, annoyed.
She can wait, Sharon said,
and with a dismissive sweep of his hand, he pushed the boy aside and took us down a connecting hallway.
Look here, Millard said. Jacob has important business with Miss...
Our business is the same,
Sharon said so loudly, Millard stopped talking. We descended into the basement as Ulysses followed, scowling, then passed through rooms crowded with machines that had been rumbling and filling the air with noise the last time I'd seen them, but were now silent. Then we were hurried through a room I'd never been in before, crammed with what looked like telegraph and radio equipment. Several people were sitting together wearing headphones and looks of deep concentration, and in the corner was a knock-kneed man who wore a tuxedo wrapped in radio wires, with antennae poking up from the top of his hat. A loud, warbling whine was emitting from an electronic box hung from his neck. Or was that sound coming from the man himself?
Monitoring secret channels for white communications, Sharon said to me.
Ulysses cleared his throat nervously.
It's nothing of the kind, he said. Ignore all this, you've seen nothing.
He rushed us out of the room, muttering to himself. Finally, we came to the heart of Bentham's machine, a room